Hi, it's Helen Hebert, and I'm here at the University of Iowa with Tatiana Ginsburg. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi, Helen.
How are you?
Good, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're here, I'm here in Iowa teaching a workshop in the papermaking classroom. It's been fun, today is day two. And Tatiana, I just wanted to ask you, how did you get, what was your first interest in handmade paper?
My first interest in handmade paper probably goes back to my childhood. I was really interested in origami. I grew up in New York City, and we had that origami Christmas tree.
Right.
And so I don't know if that was, that paper wasn't handmade, but I was very fascinated by folding paper and things that paper would do, and little paper umbrellas and all those kinds of things, like how it could be manipulated, how it could be so different, the same material. So then the first time I ever made paper was when I was an undergraduate at Sarah Lawrence College. And my printmaking professor, Chris Phillips, had built a Hollander beater and taught a papermaking class during the summer. And that was really fascinating to me. And we didn't make great paper, and I certainly didn't know what I was doing with it, but there was something there that really interested me. So she suggested that I intern at Dudenay.
Right.
That was early 90s, so back at Crosby Street, and I interned there for a little while. And then later, I took a class with Mina Takahashi at Dudenay some years later in Asian papermaking. So she was teaching Japanese. And that was like some kind of little light bulb went off in my head, and I was like, this.
Did you do dyeing in that workshop?
We did coloring. Asian fibers was one of them, so she would do...
Because I wonder if we were there together.
Oh, maybe,
because
yeah.
I took one weekend with her.
That would be so cool, yeah. She did these weekend workshops, right? So we did, I know there was one that was called Coloring Asian Fibers, where we used a fiber reactive dye and also a pigment.
Indigo.
Yeah. That's funny.
I bet we were there together.
Yeah. That's cool.
That's neat.
And then she taught another one, the year later, and then I started, pestering her, saying, Mina, you need to teach us all the time. She said, I can't teach us all the time. You need to go to Iowa. And at the time, I was working at the Metropolitan Museum, and I would go to Japan for printing calendars and note cards and things like that for the museum. So I met Richard Flavin.
Okay.
I talked to him. I sort of thought, oh, should I just come to Japan and study somehow? And he said, no, you should go to Iowa and you should study with him.
Her message, yeah.
So, after getting that reinforcement from a number of people, I decided that I really should come here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 2001 that I moved here. So I moved my everything here just to take one class with Tim, and my boyfriend at the time, is now my husband, came with me, and then I ended up staying here for 2 years, working out at Oakdale, studying with Tim, and Lynn Amley was here at that time,
okay.
too.
Did you get a degree?
Yeah, I got a
certificate. Okay.
So at that time, there wasn't an MFA, which we now have here, which is great. We really wanted to have that at that time, but it wasn't happening. So when I graduated with the certificate, I had applied for a Fulbright to go to Japan to study natural dyes based on going to special collections here, looking at paper samples and trying to recreate them and sort of finding I didn't really have enough information just from the sample book. Lo and behold, I got this grant and I kind of couldn't believe it. And so I went to Japan, and I ended up staying in Japan for almost 2 years. So the Fulbright was a year, and I sort of extended my time there to learn as much as I could.
And so just tell me a little bit about what you did there. Did you visit specific dyers? Did you take workshops?
Yeah, I visited papermakers around the country, and I had this real misconception about what I was going to do. I thought I would find a papermaker who did dyes and study there. And then I realized that a lot of the papermakers didn't do a lot of dyeing. Even if they had a few dyed papers that they sold, that was kind of a really occasional work for them.
Okay.
and that some of them didn't even do the dyes in-house. They sent it out. So I was introduced to a textile dyer, Yoshioka Sachio, and his family had been doing dyes for many generations, and they dye everything.
Mm-hmm.
The first day I visited, they were dyeing rocks with natural dyes. So it was just, you know, basically any fiber, though.
And they're putting the dye on ready-made paper, if they were doing paper.
Although,
it's not in the pulp.
Actually, they did both.
Okay.
So interestingly, sometimes, mostly they would do dyeing finished sheets, either by brushing or dipping.
Mm-hmm.
Or occasionally a paper maker would send them beaten pulp, you know, sort of by the equivalent of UPS. It would show up, you know, in a box, and we would dye it and then squeeze out all the water and send it back to the paper maker, and then they would make sheets out of it. So that happened a couple of times while I was there with indigo, or one time that we did lotus dye for a temple with that had harvested lotus leaves, and they wanted it to be sort of all put together and made a dye out of that leaf material.
So I think a lot of people are really interested in natural dyeing. Can you describe the entire process for one particular, like you're talking about the lotus leaf, or one that you practiced or witnessed?
Sure. The lotus leaf is one I often give in workshops because it's you can buy lotus leaves in Asian grocery stores, and they're really inexpensive, so it's a nice thing that's a little more accessible.
Right.
Some of the Asian dyes are hard to find in this country. So basically what you do is you take the dried leaves, even though it seems like you want fresh leaves, they're actually much better when they're dry. And you put them in you put them in water, and you bring that water to a boil. So you start with cold water for the most oxygen, kind of like making tea. You always start with fresh cold water. And you extract twice, usually. So you boil it for 20 or 30 minutes, strain out all the liquid, and put more water on, and take another extraction from the same leaves. And then you normally mix those two extractions together. So there's some times where there's exceptions, because they can yield slightly different color ranges, so you can select. And then in Japan, what they do for almost all the dyes is they dye the material, whether it's finished paper, cloth, whatever it is. Then they use a mordant. And the mordants are usually alum or iron. They use very simple mordants, which are basically very safe in Japan, not any of the ones that you really have to worry about.
And so they're dipping it in a mordant solution after the dyeing?
For the same amount of time as the dyeing. So if you dyed for 20 minutes, you would soak it in the mordant for 20 minutes, or if you brushed it on, you would just brush it on. And then usually it's rinsed after the mordant and then dyed again. So they call that middle mordant, or nakabaisen, which is supposed to give the best light fastness and color fastness, because you don't have extra mordant. You have dye on both sides, sort of.
Right.
And the extra mordant, because it is the type of thing we would normally not want in paper. For example, alum is something that is very acidic, or iron is something we filter out of the water here. But that fixes the color, and it also changes the color.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on what color you're looking for, you need to get that color through that sort of whole process. If you loved the first color you got, you have to come up with another way to get there, because you wouldn't have a light, fast, or stable color at the end.
And so what color are you making with the lotus leaf? What color range?
Usually it's bright yellow to sort of green-gray. So as if you put alum, you get brighter colors, so it yields a yellow with the alum. And if you use iron, you get a darker color.
Right.
So you get sort of that. But they're still related in some ways. Some other dyes that we use a lot are very pH reactive, so they go very extremely to purples or to blues, kind of like hydrangeas can be changed depending on the soil. And in Japan, the dyer that I studied with they really tried to use a lot of materials that were local and natural in all the parts of the process. You know, there's ways that you can get a lot of sort of chemicals even into the natural process, but they tried to use things like plants that draw alum from the soil
mm-hmm.
can sometimes be used where they make an ash of those plants and they make a lye out of that
mm-hmm.
so that they would sort of really be getting it in the most natural way, or natural rock alum. I also studied with another dyer, just sort of visited them periodically and would stay there for a couple of days in Aichi, and that was Shikari, Mrs. Shibata, who I had studied with another really important family
mm-hmm.
in Japan, you know, that had gone back many years, Yamazaki Seiju's family, and he wrote a number of books on dyes, as did the person I studied
okay.
with. So those are kind of the main people that had done research on it. And what's interesting really is that the idea sort of natural dyes is a relatively recent idea, because we didn't need to distinguish between natural and chemical until, in Japan it really wasn't until the 20th century that,
right. uh-huh.
and even the first chemical dyes are late 19th century. So now we sort of talk about natural dyes, but all dyes were natural dyes.
Right.
So here in yeah. Iowa, there's a tradition of natural dyeing
mm-hmm.
in the Amana colonies, or in, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of other communities.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you used what you had, you know.
Right, yeah. Okay, and so then, tell me a little bit about how you use the natural dyeing in your work. So you're an artist, and you are also a teacher,
mm-hmm.
educator. You've taught in many different capacities. You're here this semester. And I know you do installations as well. So tell me a little bit about what you're working on now, or whatever
yeah.
you want.
I like working with natural dyes, because I feel like as an artist, that's, you know, dyeing with natural dyes is more expensive and time consuming than
mm-hmm.
it is to dye with chemical dyes. So in a commercial setting, at this point when we're all used to getting t-shirts from the Gap for cheap,
right.
it's not really that viable, right? But I think as an artist, you have this opportunity to show people things and to put time into the way that they're made.
Right.
That it's kind of a luxury,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think that when I use natural dyes in a paper installation or a book or something, it's putting people in contact with things that they maybe don't get to see otherwise.
Sure.
And so that sort of, I feel like that's something that's almost a little bit of like a mission or something as an
mm-hmm.
artist and an educator, to like actually say, look, here, touch this, hold this, look at it, see what's different about this.
Right.
That this color range is different than the colors that we're getting from something else, or that it has certain qualities. And some of them are rather fugitive, in the meaning that they don't last as
mm-hmm.
well as some of the commercial ones. But that also can be really beautiful. That can create, you know, we have a culture of permanence, but actually, historically, people really often had a culture of ephemeral
mm-hmm.
Beauty, so they
right.
appreciated things that didn't last or that faded.
Yeah.
So that's something that interests me.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of paper installation, I think it's important, as you do too, to get people to move around paper in a different way than they
mm-hmm.
do when they're just handling office paper
right.
all day long. And to think about it as a material that can do more than we sometimes think.
Yeah.
And can have a presence on its own. And that we, you know, we've used for the transmission of culture for so many years that it's so layered, the idea of paper. But we also think of it as something that's not very permanent, which is kind of crazy, because the paper materials that we have that are 1,000 years old are in better shape than the textiles, in better shape than many of the other materials.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, it is an idea of relative permanence, you know, maybe not as permanent as DNA samples, but
right. yeah.
Like
yeah. And so I also know that did you do any papermaking in Japan? Or you just did that when you were studying in Iowa?
I visited papermakers,
okay.
but I didn't study papermaking
right.
there.
So I know you kind of, you've integrated the Japanese papermaking techniques into your artwork and do hybrid Western and Asian. Well, you tell me, you'll say it better than I am, but I think that's unique. There aren't that many artists kind of melding the two, and it's probably because they train one way or another, but you have this. And I guess most students that come to Iowa get both, which is great.
Yeah, I think that's something that's really special about this program, mm-hmm. that you get exposed to a lot of papermaking styles and that you can really see what each of them might do for you.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely really was eye-opening for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took me a long time sort of to integrate all those things myself, just
sure.
thinking through, you know, what you learn, the historical techniques. One thing I like to do a lot is I like to make Asian paper, even though it's time-consuming to prep the fibers and all of that. It also is sometimes more manageable if you're working alone
mm-hmm.
than setting up a whole studio. You know, I have an Asian paper making setup for an 18 by 24 spaghetti that I can set up on a porch, or I can set up in a driveway. You
right.
know, I've lived in various places where I don't really have a full studio, so you can kind of do that. And then, so I tend to also like to manipulate Asian papers for their particular qualities. So in Western paper, we say the paper is made in the beater.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the way that you beat the fiber determines essentially the finished sheets, although of course there's other factors, how thick the paper is, things like
right.
that. But with Asian paper, I feel like a lot of it's the fiber prep too, but it's in different ways. It's how you scrape it, it's how you pick it, it's how you beat it, and it's actually a lot about how you rinse it. So I've started to get really interested in tracking, if I'm making an addition of something, how am I rinsing this material, how much of the darker, crispier hemicellulose am I rinsing out, how am I keeping it. And I like to use Asian paper in my work because it's so durable and flexible.
Mm-hmm.
I can get very thin and strong sheets that also can withstand a lot of abuse. So if I'm printing on them, and sometimes if I go to print on Western paper, I forget, oh, I can ding this, and it's like, forget it, you won't get
right.
it out. Whereas if I'm printing on Asian paper, I can basically, it's so forgiving.
Yeah.
And so I like to use it for that reason, and really also the way that you use abaca for its translucency.
Mm-hmm.
I use kozo and gompi mixed together, or some different Asian fibers to get translucency versus strength, or get certain qualities, wet strength, layering, multiple layers of something, embedding string or other kinds of material.
Right.
And I often use some kind of pulp painting on top, either stencils through like a silk screen
mm-hmm.
if I want a very definite image, or just sort of like icing a cake with literally like an icing syringe, you know, just writing by hand with Western overbeaten pulp that's just beaten so fine that it will go through a pulp painting kind of technique on top of Asian fibers. And I really like the way those two things work together. I often don't like cotton as a base sheet.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it doesn't have enough life, so I like to use Asian fibers as the base and then do something with short beaten cotton on top for the decorative effect or for an image in pulp.
Right. Great. Is there anything else we should talk about? Class is starting fairly soon here, but...
Thank you for being here, Helen.
Yeah.
It's been great, and I think the students are really getting a lot out of it, as am I. I've never taken a workshop with you, even though we've known each other
yeah,
for a long time.
Yeah, I haven't with you either, so
very
we'll
fun.
Okay, thanks, Tatiana.
You're welcome.